My name is Esther Men, for those of you who haven't been here before. And this week we've been looking at some women in the Old Testament. I entitled this whole series, The Power of the Powerless, in quotation marks, Women Who Shaped Biblical History. And in this week I wanted to look at five women, five examples of women in the Old Testament who are present at very critical moments in the biblical story. They're women that are sometimes overlooked as we tell the story that's in the Old Testament. So I wanted to explore some of those stories and point out the strength of these women, different points in history here. On Monday we looked at Rebecca and saw that she had a very strong personality and looked at her role in directing God's blessing through Jacob's line. And then yesterday we looked at Tamar and the origins of the Davidic genealogy. Now today we're going to move ahead to another very important period in Israelite history, perhaps the foundational event in the history of this people, that's the Exodus. And all of us have that image of Moses going up to Pharaoh and defying Pharaoh, saying, "Let my people go." But if you look at the first two chapters of the book of Exodus, which is what we'll do today, you'll see that the women were there first, defying Pharaoh in the ways that they were able to. And before we move to these stories, which are told in a very brief fashion in these chapters, why don't we review a little bit the situation, the setting for these stories. Now, I'm sure all of you know the story of Joseph and his brothers and how they got down to Egypt. Joseph being sold into slavery and then his family eventually following because of the great famine. Now, it's interesting to notice where these people settled when they got down to Egypt. And they're treated, first of all, as guests and promised the best land. If you look at Genesis 45, 17 through 20, you'll see their status there as Joseph and Pharaoh speak. Genesis 45, 17 through 20. Would somebody please read that and tell us what translation you're using?
RSV.
Thanks.
45, 17 to...
17 to 20. Mm-hmm.
And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Say to your brothers, do this. Load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan. And take your father and your household and come to me. And I will give you the best of the land of Egypt. And you shall eat the fat of the land. Command them also, do this. Take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. Give no thought to your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours."
Okay, give no thought to your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. So they're going to be treated very well as guests by Pharaoh, and in fact they're even going to, it doesn't say that here, excuse me. So anyway, they're going to be treated very well by Pharaoh. Now when they actually come down here, when they get their carts and get all of their family and so forth and come down here, Joseph's a little worried about where they're going to live. Are they going to live right here by the Nile? This is actually the best land, the best agricultural land. The Nile rises every year and it waters and fertilizes this whole plain here, the whole river plain. So, but will they live here in the center? Let's look here at what Joseph says. This is in Genesis 46, 37 through 47, 6. Joseph has a different idea. It says 46, 31 down to 47, 6.
Here in the RSV, Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of cattle. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? You shall say, your servants have been keepers of cattle from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, in order that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. When Joseph went in and told Pharaoh, my father and my brothers, the flocks and herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan. They are now in the land of Goshen. And from among his brothers he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? And they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, as our fathers were. They said to Pharaoh, we have come to search in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks. For the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. And now we pray you, let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any able men among them, put them in charge of my cattle.
Okay. So, Joseph says, listen, tell them that you're shepherds, and then they won't bother you. In fact, they'll want you to live kind of on the borders. There's no, we don't know this phrase here, all shepherds are abhorrent to Egyptians. There's no external data that we have that supports that, no Egyptian source or anything. But this was primarily an agricultural society, and some people say, well, they had gods that were in the form of rams and so forth, so maybe the whole sacrificial system was, you know, abhorrent because the Israelites were killing members of the flocks. But anyway, we don't know exactly what that means. But in any event, Joseph wants his brothers not to live in the center here, but toward the edge here in this land of Goshen. And so Pharaoh says, okay, fine, you know, wherever you want, take the best of the land, you know, your pick, you pick. So they pick this, and he says, you can also be my shepherds, too, of the royal livestock. So they're living out here, not in the middle, in what comes to be very highly centralized and controlled government agricultural land, but out here toward the edge where they can have their own relative freedom, maybe. So they can also get away when they need to. It's interesting, and if you were to read on in chapter 47, Joseph, if you remember, is in charge of administering the program, the distribution of food that's going on during this famine. And all the Egyptians here, they pay all their money. They bring all their money to Joseph and to Pharaoh, and they buy the grain that's been stored up. And then later on, they bring all their livestock, and they still buy grain. And finally, they have nothing. If you look at 47:18, the year was ended. They came to him the next year and said, we cannot hide from my lord that with all the money and animal stocks consigned to my lord, nothing's left at my lord's disposal save our persons and our farmland. Let us not perish before your eyes, both we and our land. Take us in our land in exchange for bread, and we with our land will be serfs to Pharaoh. Provide the seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become a waste. So, in a kind of ironical fashion, Joseph is seen as administering the land during a period when there's a great centralization, and all the people of Egypt become slaves to the government. Interesting. We usually study the story of the Israelites and their freedom from captivity, but we've noticed that this is a folk tale, and I'm sure that the people delighted in having one of their own depicted as going to this nation and overseeing it during the time that it was centralized and all the people become slaves working for the government. And this was a highly organized society over here. Here Joseph's depicted as the one who organized it all, in charge of all of that. But one might suppose that his family was living on the edges and not involved in this transition of all the people into slavery. Now, when we turn then to our period today, Joseph's died and all of his brothers have died. If we look at the first chapter of Exodus, there were 70 people that came down to Egypt, but then they all died, and then there was a population explosion. People, it says in Exodus 1:7, were fertile and prolific, and they multiplied and increased very greatly, so that the land was filled with them. So here we have a fulfillment of some of those promises we've seen to Abraham, to Isaac and Jacob, to become a great people. It's happening now. And also it seems there's a reference to the commandment in the first chapter of Genesis to be fruitful and multiply. So they're becoming very many. And now we have a new situation arising here. So would somebody read here from Exodus 1:8 on to the end of the chapter?
New King James.
Thank you.
Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it happened in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, put them in Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor."
Great. Why don't we pause here for a minute, actually, because we've set up a new scene here. So you have a new Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Times have passed. And here we have, in this land, this group of people, these pastoral people. Now, what's interesting to know is we know from archaeological digs and so forth that in this area right here in the 14th century, so let's say around 1300 BC or so, there's a large number of fortresses being built right here. And also the literary evidence that we have tells of invasions from this part into Egypt. So the situation has changed. There's some kind of aggression from outside, and we see in this chapter here that the Egyptians are afraid that these people who've been living out here will join forces with these enemies. So they become a danger here. And to deal with this danger, then the people are enslaved as a people, and they're set to building these big cities, storehouses, it calls them. And there is some extra biblical reference to the cities, these big, actually they're fortresses, and the references to Pitom and Ramses. We don't have references to them until around the 7th century BC though, so chronology is a little funny. And actually, as we read the story, you'll see the story-like quality of it. That it doesn't seem that their main concern was to designate it which pharaoh and when and so forth, but there's a legendary quality to the story. However, this was happening during this period, and we can imagine that perhaps this was the period when the Israelites were enslaved. There was a king called Ramses II, and he lived during the 13th century, and there were a large number of building projects under him too. So people who try to figure out which pharaoh was the pharaoh of the Bible often choose Ramses II as their man. So there's this climate of fear of the outsider as a potential enemy. And they set them to work, they enslaved them. Slavery in the ancient Near East was a very common institution. And you have evidence both in the Bible and also in other literature. You have evidence that captives from war were often used as slaves. You also have some slave trade going on. Foreign slaves were traded. Joseph's an example of that. He was carried down into the land and sold as a slave. And then other ways too. You could sell yourself into slavery, as the Egyptians are depicted as doing, and so forth. But anyway, in this case, the whole people is enslaved and set to work building the structures for the empire. Actually, they're set to work strengthening their oppressors, interestingly enough. There's this fear. But still, even though they're working hard, they still are getting stronger and stronger. It's not working. So let's read on. Do you want to continue reading? Here we have our champions for the day coming up.
Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women, and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.
Okay, thanks. So the oppression hasn't worked here. Trying to get the people to conform and do the work here, treating them very harshly, but still they're multiplying and multiplying. So now a little more direct action here. The king of Egypt speaks to these Hebrew midwives named Shiphrah and Puah. I had a professor one time, and he told a story. He said on one of his exams, there was a question, what are the names of the two Hebrew midwives? And his answer was, I don't know, and I don't care. But their names were Shiphrah and Puah, and I think that they're really some of the most interesting characters in this whole story, because they're the first resistors. They say no. And notice the humor in their explanation, too. They say they're instructed to kill the males as soon as they're born, when the women are at the birth stool. And we know from some archaeological evidence in Egypt, and also from some of the literary sources, that women would give birth not lying down as we do today, but kneeling or sitting on a stool. And so this is what this refers to here. But they resist. They don't do it. And then they lie to Pharaoh. He's asking, now, you know, what's going on? There's all these boy children. And they're like, well, the Hebrew women are lively. They're energetic. You know, they give birth just like that. No problem. You Egyptian women, you know, it's a hard thing and so forth, and you need help. But we're strong women. And so they give birth even before we're able to get there. So nothing we can do. So an instance of civil disobedience here.
This in verse 21, he said, and that he provided, and so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. The word is batim, which means houses, house, and here sometimes houses means households or families. And if you've been to any of the other sessions this week, one of the greatest blessings in the Hebrew way of thinking was to have families, you know, especially sons and so forth. And so apparently this was a reward for their good behavior, that they had families as a reward for the action. Mm-hmm. And apparently they didn't have families before.
Yeah, but that's why mm-hmm. I was wondering why it mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's an example. The last two times, Monday and Tuesday, we've been looking at women whose primary role, or one of their primary roles anyway, is to give birth to sons and to continue that line of blessing, which is so important. But here you have two women that are acting professionally and resisting Pharaoh's order, and apparently they don't have families, but the families are seen not as their primary role, but as a reward, as something that's given after that. Short story, isn't it, unfortunately, but a clever story, an example of courage by ordinary people in resisting Pharaoh. Note the story-like character of it, too. The king of Egypt is never mentioned by name, and it seems rather unlikely that the Hebrews would have two midwives for all the people. Also, it's rather odd. Don't you think this is rather odd? When you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool, and if it's a boy, kill him, and if it's a girl, let her live. Rather strange way of dealing with a problem of birth control, right? Because why do you have?
Well, the problem with overpopulation today, you know, the population that needs to be controlled would be the fertile women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is the source.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the men.
Mm-hmm. So if the problem really is population here, looks like they're barking up the wrong tree. And earlier in the morning, at the earlier session, somebody said, well, I think this is an example of a patriarchal way of thinking. Pharaoh is thinking that only the men are strong, you know, they're the ones to worry about, and so he's killing the men, but actually it's the women who are doing the
Do you think he was
birthing.
Thinking that the more men they had, that they would be soldiers
mm-hmm.
and fight against him if they were invaded?
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why he didn't want them in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there may be even a component of humiliation, because I think of if you only begot females, only girls, that was, I think, you know, considered a very beautiful, sorry, that was a very status. Probably was an overlay of another kind of way
mm-hmm.
of pressing.
Mm-hmm. So it's humiliating. Or they wouldn't be as strong militarily, so that initial fear that that the Israelites would join with the enemies and attack. It's kind of strange if they want to use them as slave labor, though, to kill all the males too. Mm-hmm. So
I might have been thinking about using them as a genetics experiment, you know, strengthening the Egyptian race using the women.
Using the women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Strong Hebrew women, right.
Pardon me.
Yes.
If this is perhaps just an aside,
sure.
You can make it as brief as you want. But
I like aside.
I was wondering what the nature of slavery was as opposed to our experience or historical ideas of slavery being the African-American experience. I mean, what was the quality of slavery?
Well, you know, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, there's a number of different laws concerning slaves, and especially the Hebrew slave, Hebrew person could sell themselves into slavery or sell their minor children into slavery, but then after a period of 7 years, you were supposed to let them go, unless they decided to stay with you because they were well treated and because they liked you, they liked working with you, and so forth. And there's examples of slaves that have a great deal of power. I mean, even if you look at Joseph, he seems to sort of rise to great position here out of slavery because of his ability. But also in the Hebrew Bible, the slaves seem to have been more similar to like our laborers or our employees almost, you know. They were considered as property, and so they didn't have the freedom to come and go. They didn't, and I guess the treatment, although there was limitations on what you could do to your slaves, you know, their well-being was pretty much left in the hands of their owners as well. So, yeah, I've been sort of interested in this and in thinking about, was it really so different to be a slave back in those days as being, you know, a person who works for minimum wage during our days? It's a good question. We don't have the slave master, but our structures are a little more impersonal, but I don't know. It's unclear. It seems like some of the slaves do well in the Hebrew Bible, but these definitely were being pressed to their limits. If you look also, this is a whole group of people that's being used for major projects. If you look at in Kings, I believe, Solomon uses some of the tribes, the northern peoples, and actually they work in ships to do these major kind of building projects also. And that's one of the issues when his son, Rehoboam, takes power. The people from the north especially come down and they say, you know, your father really misused us because we had to build all these fortresses and we had to, you know, chop wood and we had to do all this stuff. And they said, we don't really want to do this anymore. And Rehoboam said, if you think my dad was bad, I'm, you know, 10 times worse. He said, you know, if you think my dad's arm was a strong arm, my little finger is stronger than my dad's arm. And with that, the northern people rebelled and they split off. So the whole issue of using people for projects, building projects, was a big one during that time too. Yeah.
The point that I was going to make is I think because a person could be taken into slave simply because of sort of economic political changes and through war, that even those who were slave masters at any one point in time knew that, you know, if they lost the battle, that individuals from their group could be taken into slavery. So I think that the character of what a slave was had a little different dimension. It wasn't that any given person was inherently destined to be a slave, that it had, it really was a kind of, you know, the winds of fate that blew in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that did develop in the form of slavery that developed in this country was almost a sense that those people, you know, that was their best, I mean, that was all they could be, and it has, to me, that has a very different feel than what I'm hearing in terms of that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So it has a slightly different sense.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes in this ancient context, slavery had an ethnic component because your enemies would be taken captive. But on the other hand, we also have examples of where Hebrew people would sell themselves into slavery to other Hebrew people. So then there were special provisions for those people too. You're supposed to let them go after six, you know, after the 7 years, on the seventh year. And the foreigner, you didn't have that kind of privileged, you know, caretaking. But yeah, I think you're right. It wasn't exclusively divided on racial grounds, you know. All the people of this type were slaves forever or anything like that. But a bit more fluid. Of course, we're looking at a large time period too, and the evidence isn't abundant, so it's hard to say what it would feel like in one particular period of a century, you know, too. But. All right, so here we have our first civil disobedience here against Pharaoh, the force of death here. I would like to read something to you which is interesting. If any of you were here a week ago, last Monday, we talked about God as a divine warrior, and we looked at ancient creation myth from Mesopotamia called Enuma Elish. And in that one, there were originally two gods, Apsu and Tiamat, and they mingled. They were actually the freshwater and seawater, and they mingled, and out of their mingling came all the other gods, and they became so numerous and so bothersome, so loud, that the father god wanted to kill them all. And there's another myth, too, another Mesopotamian myth, the story of Atrahasis, which has the same motif of sort of the multiplication of bothersome first gods and then people. And I think that this is interesting because it indicates that perhaps some of the literary material that was circulating in that time is being applied to this period in Israelite history. Let me read this to you. There's an emphasis throughout this opening section here in Exodus on the increase in the number of Israelites. That is, in the first place, a part of an ancient and widespread literary pattern that is most easily seen in the well-known Mesopotamian story of Atrahasis. That story, like this one, begins with hard labor. At first, the laborers are the younger gods, but they are replaced early in the story by a human labor force. The people work hard for centuries excavating canals, and irrigation canals were really important in Mesopotamia, in the area now that's Iraq and Iran. They had very good agriculture up there, but they needed the irrigation canals for that, which means that they needed a very highly organized social structure. Okay, so they were excavating canals. At the same time, they multiplied until the land is crowded and noisy, and the gods become alarmed. In particular, the great god Enlil is disturbed by the clamor and cannot sleep. He orders that supplies be withheld from the people, and that the land be afflicted with a drought. The people are decimated, but Atrahasis, the human hero of the story, eventually manages to end the drought with the help of Enki, a favorably inclined god. The people again multiply, and again the land becomes crowded. Enlil, this god, afflicts the people a second time, but Atrahasis and Enki fend off this disaster too. Finally, Enlil instigates a great flood. Acting on Enki's instructions, however, Atrahasis constructs a large boat and saves his family, thus preserving human life. This story is often compared to the biblical story of Noah and the flood. Its literary pattern, however, is closer to the story of the affliction of the Israelites in Egypt. The people are working very hard, but they're nonetheless multiplying and filling the land. Pharaoh is alarmed and, like Enlil, attempts to reduce their numbers by a series of afflictions, first imposing hard labor on them, then directing the midwives to kill their sons, and finally ordering their sons to be cast into the Nile. One of these sons, Moses, is saved by being placed in the Nile in an ark. And actually, when we read the story of Moses, that the term that's being translated as basket is the same word as the word that's translated as ark in the story of Noah and the ark, Teva. And in both cases, life is preserved in Noah's ark during the flood, and the case of Moses, the future of the people, as people of God, free people of God, is preserved in Moses is in this ark.
Is that the same ark as the ark of the covenant also? Same Hebrew word?
No, that's different.
That's different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's different. Mm-hmm. But the whole problem with language is a tricky one, isn't it? Because some of our work, encompass sort of a larger sphere of meaning than the Hebrew, and others smaller, so mm-hmm. That's kind of tricky. The arks of Atrahasis and Noah preserve human life, while the ark of Moses preserves the life of the man who will eventually liberate his people from bondage. So let's look at that story now, a segue into the second chapter of Exodus. And our second pair, actually there's three women here who defy Pharaoh's order to throw all the boys into the Nile, that great source of life, which is now an instrument of death. Would somebody please read chapter 2 up to verse 10?
Meanwhile, a certain man of the house of Levi went ahead and took a daughter of Levi. And the woman became pregnant and brought a son to birth. When she saw how good looking he was, she kept him concealed for 3 years. When she was no longer able to conceal him, she then took for him an ark of papyrus and coated it with skin and pitch and put the child in it and put it among the reeds by the bank of the river Nile. Further, his sister stationed herself at a distance to find out what would be done with him. After a while, Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the Nile River, and her female attendants were walking by the side of the Nile River, and she caught sight of the ark in the middle of the reed. Immediately, she sent her slave girl that she might get it. When she opened it, she got to see the child, and here the boy was weeping. At that, she felt compassion for him, although she said, "This is one of the children of the Hebrews." Then her sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and specially call for the nursing woman from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" So Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." At once the maiden went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter then said to her, "Take this child with you and nurse him for me, and I myself shall give you your wages." Accordingly, the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew up. Then she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter so that he became a son to her. And she proceeded to call his name Moses and to say, "It is because I have drawn him out of the water."
Okay. So, here we have our second story of rebellion by the women before the Exodus here. And notice again the humor in this story. These are great folk stories here. When Pharaoh's daughter goes down and gets the child, then Moses' sister asks, "Well, do you need a nursemaid?" And so the child is actually given back to his own mother to be nursed. And they nursed their children for 2 or 3 years, so she had a number of years here. And also, she's paid. So it's great. She gets the child and she's paid. The humor in outwitting the greater structures that are. And eventually then, Moses goes to live in Pharaoh's household. And so you have the child who grows up to be the man who frees the Hebrews growing up in Pharaoh's own household. So there's a sort of an internal bringing down the house. And Pharaoh's daughter, too, is a character here. She defies her father's order because of her pity.
Interesting to see the collusion between these two women because they both know what they're doing.
Which two women?
I would think between Pharaoh's daughter and Moses' mother.
Oh, you think so? Okay.
Well, sure. I think without saying anything, they both understand that there's a collusion between this child. And they ignore the power system.
So it's woman to woman here. Any other observations, comments, and reactions to the story?
I read a legend somewhere that Moses' mother and sister worship on Tila or in Hebrew legend.
Oh, really? Yeah, let's look and see who Moses' mother and Moses' sister were. And we have some sites here in the Hebrew Bible where they're named. It's interesting, as in the story earlier where Pharaoh is never mentioned, it has that story-like quality. Here it has that story-like quality, you know, there's a mother and there's a daughter and there's Pharaoh's daughter, and the only one who's named is Moses here, the one whose story is told more fully in the chapters that come. But Moses' mother does have a name in the Hebrew Bible. I haven't heard that particular legend. So if you want to look at this name here, look at Exodus 6:20, and you'll see that Moses' mother has a name. Exodus 6:20. Amram is the father. So would somebody read that?
Amram took the wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. The years of the life of Amram being 137 years.
Okay, great. So, his father's sister, his aunt. Marriage in the family again. That's a big thing in these genealogies. So he married his aunt Jochebed. So that's the mother of Moses. Interestingly enough, they don't mention Marian in this genealogy right here. It's just Aaron and Moses, Aaron being the oldest of the sons. And also you can look at Numbers 26, 59. And would somebody read that? That's Numbers 26, 59. Oh, Marian gets in there finally. Okay, good. So we do have some names of these people eventually in the Hebrew Bible. They're buried in the genealogies there. So. Jochebed and Miriam. And we never learn Pharaoh's daughter's name in this story, but we never learn Pharaoh's name either. As far as Moses, the name it could be from the Hebrew root mashah, which means to draw out, or actually there are a lot of names in Egyptian that have this name as part of it, if you think like Tutmosis and so forth, and it means son of. So it could
or
be
even Ramses, right? Son of Ray.
Ramses.
Moses.
Yeah, you got a good point. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. So these are two wonderful stories before Moses takes the center of the stage here. We might ask, well, what happens to these women? We don't ever hear about Shifra and Puah anymore, except that they have families, so they're taken care of. Jochebed we lose sight of. But Miriam is one that continues to be evident, present every once in a while as the story continues. And she's considered, in one passage anyway, to be part of the central leadership. If you look at Micah 6:4, we have a description of the bringing up from the land of Egypt, and we have Miriam mentioned here. This is in Micah 6:4. Can we find it? Micah 6:4. Great. Oh, just the one verse, right. Mm-hmm.
This is RSV.
Thank you.
For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam.
And Miriam. Okay, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, the three leaders. And then she's also, if you look at Exodus 15, she appears after the crossing of the Reed Sea here in 15:20 through 21. Let somebody read that. 15:20 through 21.
Then the prophet Miriam, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and with dancing. Miriam sang to them, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea."
Okay, so here she's called a prophet. Now her role as prophet isn't fleshed out. in the records that we have, but here she's called a prophet, and she's singing after the victory here, leading the women in dancing. Some have compared her actions here with music and so forth with some of the prophets that appear in the book of Samuel when Saul goes up to seek his father's donkeys and then Samuel anoints him king. He's coming, then Saul comes back down to his family and he runs into a group of prophets, a prophetic band, and they're playing their instruments. I guess literally it's prophetic band. They're playing instruments and singing, and they're kind of in wild frenzy. And then Saul also becomes ecstatic and begins singing and prophesying with them. So there was one tradition of the prophet that was sort of an ecstatic prophet, playing music and so forth, filled with the Spirit. And some people have suggested that maybe Marian was this type of prophet because she's singing and playing her timbrel or her tambourine. I don't know. I think it just mentions that she was a prophet, but never tells what her actual role was. And you do have other women prophets in the Old Testament. You have one named Huldah, who's found in the book of Kings. When the king Josiah, during his reign, some scrolls were found in the temple. This is around 622 BC or so. And there were all these instructions, and Josiah was quite worried. He didn't really know what to make of these scrolls, so he said, well, go consult the prophet Huldah, the prophetess Huldah. And it's clear that she is female, and they appealed to her as their highest authority to tell them what to do. But we don't know anything about Huldah either. You know, it's really interesting. It's stated, okay, let's go look at Huldah the prophetess, but we don't know anything about her story. And she tells them, you know, you better pay attention to what's written there and shape up. And they do. They follow her advice. We also have Deborah the prophetess in Judge, and we know Judges, and we know a little bit more about her. We know she's sits under a tree, and people come to her, consult her for oracles and so forth. And she also musters the people to go into military battle against the armies of Sisera.
She's pretty interesting.
Deborah. Yeah, she is. Very strong woman character. So, she's probably our strongest example of what a prophetess mm-hmm. may have done. Very strong character. But here Miriam's just called a prophet. Whether she had some kind of role in activating the Hebrews and all in their movement, I don't know. It doesn't really say much about her. And in fact, things kind of go from scant to worse. The next time she's mentioned is in Numbers 12. And this is a chapter, a rather curious chapter here. Miriam and Aaron get angry at Moses. Apparently, Moses has married a Cushite woman. The Cushites were the Ethiopians. So he's married a woman outside of the people. And they're criticizing him for that. They're also, if you notice in verse 2, they're criticizing him for taking on all the responsibility and the prestige, and say, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? You know, aren't we prophets also? The Lord heard it. Now Moses was a very humble man, more than any other on the earth. This is always a
this great is really in his humbleness.
What's that?
Great in his humbleness.
Great in his humbleness. Well, I'm getting a little off the subject here. I wanted to talk about Miriam, but this is always one of the this is always one of the passages that confused people that wanted to say that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible. Because they said, how could a very humble man write that he was very, very humble? He's kind of bragging about his humility here. But anyway, so the Lord appears to these three and says that, no, Moses, my servant Moses is a very special type of prophet. There's no separation here with this humble man. I speak to him mouth to mouth plainly, and so forth. And so as then the Lord departs and the cloud withdraws from the tent, which would signify the presence of God, Miriam is stricken with leprosy. She's totally white. Now Aaron isn't, but Miriam is.
So they criticized Moses for marrying a black woman. Now we have a white Miriam, sort of the color contrast, but it's the woman who gets it. Well, Aaron at least is kind of nice and says, Aaron says to Moses, "Oh my Lord, account not to us the sin which we committed in our folly. Let her not be as one dead who emerges from his mother's womb with half his flesh eaten away." So then God Moses prays to God, and for 7 days, then she's outside of the camp, and then she's readmitted. The people wait for her, and they move on. A weird, weird story. Yeah, Miriam gets it.
Yeah, I'm confused here. It says that Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses,
mm-hmm.
but yet doesn't it say down here that God says you wouldn't speak against him?
Where is that? I'm sorry.
It's a 9. Is it 8?
Oh, I see. How then did you not shrink from speaking against me? How then did you not shrink from speaking against? In other words, why did you?
Yeah, it's a double negative.
Oh, okay.
Why
that's
did
what
you
I'm
speak against?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. It's double negative. Kind of not too polite there, but anyway. So Miriam gets it here, and Aaron seems to get off scot free. And then the next time we hear about Miriam, she's dead in Numbers 21, out in the wilderness. Well. It's a figure that's definitely eclipsed. We have a strong portrayal of her in the beginning when she saves her brother, but then we don't really hear very much about her. And this is one of the problems in reclaiming some of the stories of the women in the Bible. You know, we can study the stories of women in the Bible and we can recognize that we haven't even heard some of the stories that are there. But when we study the Bible, we also see that we don't even have the whole story. The emphasis is on the story of the men, and so it's a little disappointing at certain points. Well, we have just a few minutes here after that sort of depressing thought here for some comments, reactions to any of the things that you've heard here. Are these women in any way models for the kind of actions that we take in our lives? Perhaps is one direction we could go, or any kind of discussion here.
I just think of the importance of kind of the culture of resistance in starting a liberation movement, and how the women portrayed that long before, I don't know how long it was before Moses arose, but you know, he was kind of the put out as the point person, and yet it was a real common resistance movement that that everybody participated in, and he was raised in both that culture and then the culture of the oppressor, so that when he went back, he knew the inside and the outside. And that kind of tore him apart too, I think, but was critical for his role.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good point. There was a kind of a culture of resistance, and I think that the Bible portrays that in these very humble women, you know, the midwives, and very ordinary actions, the midwives resisting, and also the hiding of a baby. You know, it's very simple actions, but directly against Pharaoh's order.
There's a good illustration of that in Mishner's book, Poland, where the women in Poland are baking bread for the resisting soldiers, and they're the Nazis say you can't bake bread, so they bake bread at night, and they say you can't bake bread, so they, you know, hide it out in the woods, and they continue to bake bread. Their contribution to the resistance.
Thanks.
I couldn't help but be struck. It's specifically related to women, but in the section talking about the oppression, during time of oppression and a kind of flourishing of the population growing, in terms of the modern situation in that part of the world where it's the Palestinians who have been shunted off into camps and are, you know, heavily oppressed and in fact the same thing has happened, that their population has exploded, and it's one of the one of the great pressure points now, because their population is higher than that of the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of, you know, the same issue. And in terms of women in the resistance, it's very true in the Palestinian resistance in the Intifada, the women have had a very prominent role, which a lot of people who look at Muslims and the Arab world as being very suppressive of women, and that's, you know, again, kind of the broad brushstroke of trying to understand the differences, and in fact women have had an extremely prominent role in their own resistance movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, you know, in this country too, people complain about the high birth rate, you know, there's all this talk about welfare mothers, and, you know, should we give them more money if they have more kids, you know, that whole issue, like, oh, there's so many kids out there, you know, but big families and so forth, so the fear that, you know, there's too many, too much reproduction going on, we can't handle it.
But the idea that it's somehow oppression would cause the birth rate to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of evidence.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Had you ever heard of the midwives before? What are the names of the Hebrew midwives? I don't know, and I don't care. But actually, you know, they are models of simple resistance in everyday life, and I think they're good examples for us in our own lives too. Thank you very much.